And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sidney Wildsmith.
If you asked almost anyone around the world today whether Al Gore was right about global warming, they'd almost all have to admit we're in the middle of a scorcher. Record-setting heat is reaching dangerous levels, and the planet's animals have to cope with it too. Today, we find out how, and what you need to know to keep your pets safe. It's all coming up, and more, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
The sights and sounds of planet Earth this week. The morbid face of war. The torn and shredded towns. The pounding, launching tanks. The sirens' red blare. The bombs bursting in air. You'd think, or at least hope, that by now, humanity would put an end to war. No matter what the cause, or provocation, or balance of threat, to see the tangle of destruction, and we only witness the censored versions, I have to wonder as I see the suffering and the madness, and watch the expensive tanks launch expensive missiles which take down expensive bridges, and Congress people debate if we can afford to pay for the evacuation of Americans, is war perhaps getting just too expensive? Can humanity really afford much more of this? It's difficult for me, because like most of you, I sense the wonder of life on Earth. And we're squandering the gift, and in the process, missing the message. What the world needs now is peace. I encourage all of you to take the time today and tomorrow to ask for a restoration of peace on this Earth. Because we have enough troubles of our own as humans, just trying to survive the heat, which is gripping the nation and the world. People are suffering in our cities and towns from a sweltering heat wave that is setting records. And it's not just here. Europe is bracing for the same. And it makes me wonder, so how do the wild creatures deal with this? And that's what we explore today as we talk with two experts from the Humane Society of the United States who tell us what we need to know about keeping our pets safe and how do our urban wildlife neighbors manage to survive in such heat. There's a mix of great information and interesting stories from people who deal with this day in and day out. Now, following the news, we head on up to Santa Monica, where we help to celebrate the launch of an amazing electric car, the Tesla Motor Company Roadster. And if you've ever had a discussion about whether or not electric cars are doable, well, hold on to your handrails, because this story has wheels. It's a great show coming up, and so we get things fired up following the news. And so now, the news. Planet Earth is setting some new records. NASA reports that the first half of 2006 was one of the warmest on record, with an average temperature 3.4 degrees above the 20th century average, and the 12 months from July 2005 to the present were ranked as the warmest such period of the century. And this news is not going unnoticed, as the nation is sweltering under a heat wave that is causing brownouts and blackouts, and some predict that the summer is just heating up, so to speak. Europe, too, is staggering, as tropical heat is kindling reminders of the 2003 heat wave that claimed 30,000 deaths, half of which were in France. In a related story, the U.S. is expecting landfall of the second tropical storm of the season. Beryl is gaining speed and heading up the eastern seaboard. Record-high temperatures are raising the specter that 2006 may be a second record-setting hurricane season. A 7.1 Richter quake off the coast of Indonesia sent a 6-foot wall of water crashing into the fishing villages and resorts of Indonesia's Java Island, killing 368 people and leaving 200 missing. The tsunami has forced the evacuation of 54,000 people. There was no warning before the waves hit the coastal areas on Monday, this despite the efforts to set up a warming system after the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, which left 230,000 dead or missing. Fortunately, many people who witnessed the ocean's unusual receding ran for cover this time, figuring that a tsunami was inevitable. "Please don't feed the alligators" has become "if you feed, you'll have to plead guilty, or not guilty, that is, to a second-degree misdemeanor." Alligators in Florida are becoming accustomed to being fed by residents and tourists, and is feeding speculation that such is leading to an increased number of attacks by the alligators, who can become aggressive if they don't get the treats they expect. Unfortunately, the alligators are the ones which pay the ultimate price, as they must be put down to protect the human benefactors. In order to stem the increasing need to take aggressive animals down, Florida Fish and Wildlife agents are launching sting operations to identify and cite people who persist in this unfortunate behavior. In 2004, more than 7,000 alligators had to be killed after becoming just too friendly with humans. As the war in the Middle East rages, the lions and tigers at the Haifa Zoo are being transferred to bomb-proof cages to prevent their being set free due to bombs which are now hitting the city regularly and could explode in an open cage and liberate the wild creatures into the war zone. And until now, scientists weren't really sure how long whales actually live, but recent studies by scientists at Scripps Institution of Oceanography proves that many of the bowhead whales have been living free in the oceans for 160, 180, and even 200 years. It's a great bit of detective work that has led to these conclusions, and we'll be looking into this story in depth in the weeks ahead. And that's the news. Now, before we take a spin in the Tesla Roadster, I encourage you to call your kids and family and tell them to listen to segments 2 and 3 to learn some important points about how to keep your pets safe during this unbelievable heat wave. That's all coming up. But first, one of the things that intrigues me is the fact that it seems as if when life was somehow manifest, that there was crafted into its structure a wisdom gene, a gene for wisdom. And what that means is that when humans are confronted with something that really challenges their survival, that wisdom gene kicks in. That's why we're still here.
That's an optimistic view of the world, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Well, I absolutely believe in this. I'm amazed that we have within us the capacity to see solutions that otherwise we couldn't even imagine,
uh-huh,
or that haven't been done yet.
Uh-huh.
And it's part of this wisdom gene. Well, one of the things that's happening, that's the positive from the threat of global warming, is the fact that the wisdom gene is being activated dramatically. The result of that is that phenomenal numbers of terrific ideas are emerging on the planet here, which is exactly what we need right now, which is what the wisdom gene creates. And joining us now from the Bay Area up in California is the CEO of the Tesla Motor Company, Martin Eberhard. Martin, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, Martin, you've actually come up with something pretty extraordinary. I'm not going to say revolutionary, but it is in a sense revolutionary. It's a technology. It's a car.
Mm-hmm.
It's electric. But it goes way beyond that. Give us an idea of what you're unveiling to the world.
So what we're unveiling is a new electric car. From a performance perspective, it looks very different than other cars. It's a beautiful and quick sports car, 0 to 60 around 4 seconds, driving range of about 250 miles on the EPA highway driving cycle. But what's really different about it is the attitude we had toward the design of this car, in that we weren't starting off trying to build a car that's for everybody. Instead, we're building a car that's designed for enthusiasts and for drivers, and building a company starting at that point.
Well, that's kind of interesting. Some people may criticize that and say, oh, well, you're appealing to sort of an elitist green people. But, you know, the interesting thing is the fact that almost all the technologies that we now use commonly were started out, had to start out really in high performance or high application modes and space technologies and things. So I'm guessing that part of your corporate strategy was to start out there. Are we heading in the right direction?
Well, I think your comment is exactly right. I mean, there have been dozens of electric car companies over the last 30 or 40 years that that have started off with their first car trying to make the first model that will be the car that everybody can drive. And it's just not practical to break into any new market starting at the low end. And cars is no exception. You know, if we were to try to make a car that competed with a Honda Civic, there's no way that we could reach the price point even if our drivetrain was free, because we don't have the kind of purchasing efficiencies that Honda has. So the idea is to compete on performance rather than cost.
Good way to start out, because then you can always modify to as you scale up to meet needs of the average driver. But let's talk about your car, because I like to drive, mm-hmm. and I've had a variety of sports cars. I've never had a high-performance machine, but one of the little stats that I think a lot of people are going to be thrilled about is the fact that your claim is that this car will accelerate from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. Are we right about that so far?
Yep, that's right.
Well, that puts it in a league, a pretty elite league, with names like Ferrari and Lamborghini and Lotus. That's exciting stuff. You literally have a high-performance car.
Yeah, that's right. We're high-performance in acceleration. I think that if you look at the truly high-end cars like Ferraris and Porsches, I don't want to claim that we're Porsches yet. The top speed of such cars is, 150, 160, 170, even 200 miles an hour. Top speed of the Tesla car is above 130 miles an hour, so it's certainly enough to get you around on the highways, enough to win a few little races on the road, but we aren't a high-speed car yet.
I had the great pleasure of going up to L.A. a number of years back, and I forget, unfortunately, the name of the car company that was started by one of the Lee Iacocca's friends. I think it was the E-Car Company. Does that ring a bell?
Doesn't ring a bell. No.
Okay. Anyways, and they were working on electric vehicles, and so I took a test ride, some of their vehicles. This is a whole different experience in terms of drive. Explain to the listeners what it's like when you... Now, you don't call it a gas pedal. What do you call it?
That's called an accelerator.
That makes sense. Is it on the floor like a normal accelerator?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense, too.
There's two pedals. There's a gas pedal and a brake.
Very good.
Let's call it an accelerator and a brake.
There you go. Well, talk about what happens when you press on that thing, because it's a whole different experience than any other gas-powered, car that I've ever driven.
Well, that's right. The difference in experience is more than just the numbers. We can do 0 to 60 in about 4 seconds. But if you compare that to a gasoline-powered car that can do 0 to 60 in, let's say, 4.5 seconds, it's quite a different experience. The difference is this: if you hopped in a fancy Porsche or a Ferrari and wanted to do the maximum acceleration, what you'd have to do is first put the clutch in, second push the gas pedal down until you redline the engine, and then next take your foot off the clutch slowly and slip the clutch at just the right rate to get the maximum acceleration. This would cause a fair amount of stress on the clutch, and if you got it just right, you'll get a perfect launch.
Good point.
Right. And then somewhere around 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, you need to switch into second gear. So once again, you need to do a very, very quick shift to get that ideal speed and get your 0 to 60 time as advertised. If you did that to somebody else's car, you're going to be thrashing their clutch, and they're going to ask you to stop driving. An electric car is quite different. An electric car, you just step on the pedal.
Well, that's what's funny about this, because in order to achieve those acceleration rates, you have to be an expert driver.
That's right.
In the other form, whereas this one, it's like you hit the accelerator, and it's all go.
Right. At any speed, if you're driving along at 30 miles an hour and you suddenly want to accelerate quickly, you just step on it. There isn't any downshifting. There isn't any waiting for your engine to spin up, the turbocharger to kick in or whatever. The power is immediately at your toe whenever you want it.
Well, also, the car sets a new standard in the sense that you've really addressed the main problem with almost all other electric cars, and that is the range of this vehicle.
That's right.
With this performance, you've also been able to achieve quite a record in terms of the range for a production vehicle.
Right, and there's two reasons for that. First, we're using a much more modern battery technology than previous electric cars have used. We're using a lithium-ion chemistry battery technology, and there's a fair amount of our own development to make that even possible in the car. So technology is a piece of it. The other piece is, of course, embedded in our decision to make a high-performance car and not a low-price car. We can afford to put a more expensive battery pack in a car than would be possible in a low-price commuter car.
Are we going to see the Tesla motor car at drag strips and things?
I don't think we're going to be drag racing them, but they'll be on the track, I'm sure, someplace along the way.
Yeah, very.
Our goal right now is to build a streetcar, a decent, high-performing streetcar, and I think that's partly just a cost issue for the company.
The car is a beautiful car. Some people liken it to the Lotus Elise, which is elegant. You've really pulled out all the stops in terms of going for a beautifully designed car as well.
Yeah, this is actually a quite a different car than cars like the Lotus Elise and others. This is probably the only car you can buy for under $200,000 that has a carbon fiber body. The Lotus, for example, is fiberglass like a Corvette. It is styled for us by a world-class automotive stylist, and it is, everything we could do to make it a truly beautiful car that is really a sports car.
Now, this is a two-seater.
It's a two-seater.
Mm-hmm.
It's a roadster that has an optional hardtop. It has a soft top for rainy days if you don't have the hardtop with you.
And I imagine the interior is nicely appointed as well.
Yes, that's right. It's a fairly small car, so there's not a lot of room for goodies, but it has navigation system and a computer that tracks the battery usage and heated seats and air conditioning and all the stuff you'd expect in a nice car.
So let's talk about how a person actually refuels this car. How simple is that? What's the process?
It refuels more or less the same way that your cell phone refuels. You come home and you plug it in. In the morning, you unplug it, drive off. So it's just a plug that hangs on a hook in your garage. You unhook it and plug it into a socket that's right next to the driver's door.
Now, how long does it take for a full recharge?
How long does your cell phone take to recharge?
Well, about 3-4 hours, I think.
But do you really know? You think, right?
Yeah, right.
Because you don't care. As long as the charge of your cell phone is long enough to last you through the day, just as long as it charges overnight, who cares?
Right, exactly.
Right. And so with a 250-mile driving range, outside of road trips, that is enough to make it through your day. With that in mind, it's about 3 or 4 hours.
Oh, see, that's really, really extremely reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, it is not reasonable, and I'll be the first to admit it, for a road trip to Chicago. If you want to hop in your car in San Diego and drive to Chicago and stop along the way and charge, it's going to be, 200 to 250 miles per day, or at least broken up by 3-hour charging intervals.
Well, let's put it this way. It isn't the perfect car for a quick drive to Chicago. 200 to 250 miles a day is a really wonderful way to go, too. I've done that. I actually have crossed the country saying I'm going 200 miles a day, and that was fun. Of course, I had a lot of time on my hands at the time.
Yeah, for me, I'm one of these guys that's driven from Chicago to San Luis Obispo, for example, in 41 hours.
Right, right.
But, for all of your around-town driving, I live here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and for me, I have about a 15-mile commute to work. It would be perfectly reasonable for me to come to work and then drive up to San Francisco, for example, to meet friends for dinner, drive across to Berkeley and watch the sunset, drive down to San Jose and come home the long way. And that entire trip is not even close to reaching the range of the car.
Well, now let's get down to some other nuts and bolts here. So what's it going to cost? What does that actually cost in terms? I'm sure you've done the numbers. What's it cost to refuel your car?
Okay, I'm going to give you two numbers. The first is if I just were to charge it up at my house at the standard PG&E rates, then it's about $6.50 to give me a 250-mile driving range.
That's still a bargain.
So it's about 2.2 cents a mile, something like that. However, most of the power companies, for example, again here in the Bay Area, PG&E has an incentive rate for electric cars.
Oh, wow.
That takes advantage of what they call time of use charging.
Hmm.
Basically, if you charge at night when the electricity is cheaper for them, they pass it on to you. And at the incentive rate, it winds up being about a penny a mile. It's really cheap.
Well, that is really cheap.
Yeah.
Particularly
but let's be real. Mm-hmm, somebody
sure.
Who's going to buy a fancy and expensive sports car isn't really trying to save money on fuel. By the time you spent, $85,000 to $100,000 on a car, whether you save a few bucks on gas isn't the issue. The issue is much more that you're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're not using oil. You're not contributing to global warming in the way that you would with a gasoline car.
What I like about it is the fact that you've demonstrated that as we look into the future, because this is the beginning for you, and I believe you actually have an intention at some point down the road here to create those cars that consumers can use. What they can look forward to in the future is the fact that they can get these kinds of rates on cars that they would be able to afford.
That's right. Yes. Yes. And we're a small company, and we actually can't come out with a lot of models all at once. It's one at a time. But we will come out with future models of cars, it will be less expensive and probably seat more people.
How long are we going to have to wait before we are all riding around in Tesla motor vehicles?
As quickly as I can get there.
Well, let me know. I'd be happy to help you out with that. That's just an exciting vision. Because I like the way you're approaching this, which is to say, let's go with something that people really want. I certainly appreciate the design. One of the things that I find interesting is the fact that you've gotten this car to production in 3 years. I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, I'm not quite to production. I'll be in production in another, three quarters of a year or something like that.
Yeah. Okay, 3 3/4 of a year. I mean, you started this company about 3 years ago, is that?
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. And that's including raising money and building a team and assembling the car and so on. This year is spent largely in safety testing and durability testing, which is a big program. I mean, for me as a Silicon Valley kind of guy, it's been a real eye-opener as to just how long the design cycle is for a car compared to other kinds of products, largely because of the testing that has to go into a car.
Well, that is a big part of it. It costs a lot of money to have these cars certified for public use.
Yeah, well, certified isn't quite the right word, but tested this, yeah.
Okay, whatever that is, you have to have a right to drive this thing on the road. You have to have it safety tested.
Yeah, and a little bit of news. Late last week, we did our first full vehicle head-on collision test.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh.
No, I mean...
Well, it's a shame for the car.
I know.
This is a very expensive... shop-built prototype of the production car, but the good news is it survived.
Wonderful.
And it was actually, our engineers, of course, are tearing it apart now, but everything looked really good. So it's nice to see when the car performs as the computer models predict.
Well, now, for people who want to learn more about the Tesla Motor Company, help them out.
If you want to know more about Tesla Motors, come to our website. It's www.teslamotors.com. There'll be lots and lots of details of the car for you to see there.
Another aspect of this is the fact that you've had some interesting players who helped finance this. One of the things I'm curious about is to what degree are they in this? Obviously, everyone wants to make a profit, and they certainly have that as their motive. But as well, from this level of player, are you seeing a similar type of commitment to green and sustainable and clean tech?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anybody who's an investor would say that investing in a new car company is not maybe the safest way to make lots of money. When we founded this company, and it was just me and a couple of other guys trying to start a car company, we looked around for somebody to invest. And the person we found was Elon Musk, who is the CEO of a company called SpaceX, making rocket ships. And he saw what we're doing. And I believe that if he wasn't busy making rocket ships, he would be making electric cars. He's that much of a believer. And he would be doing it, again, not because he thinks it's the quickest way to make money, but because he deeply believes that we need to do something about our oil consumption. For both geopolitical and environmental reasons. And he's been not only a strong investor, having invested nearly $30 million of his own personal money in the company, he's been involved with the company along the way very, very strongly in terms of making sure we made a car that was beautiful and the right kind of design to the feature sets that were right, to encouraging us actually to spend more money on getting it right than I, as a startup guy, would like to spend.
Now, of course, a lot of people are talking about the hybrid car as the car of the future, you're going strictly electric.
Mm-hmm.
What's the trade-off there? What do you see? Do you expect at some point electric cars to be the dominant car?
Absolutely. I mean, hybrid cars are a good intermediate solution for some portions of the automotive segment. But hybrid cars, in the end, burn gasoline. And if you want to get off of gasoline, you can't be using it in your car. And electric cars are just fundamentally more efficient than any gasoline car will be, hybrid or otherwise. The difficulty with electric cars for now is getting an affordable battery pack to get to the kind of range that you want to drive your car.
These things will all be resolved in the future. There's every reason to know that they will.
Oh, yes.
It's the technology is advancing tremendously fast. Well, Martin Eberhard, CEO of the Tesla Motor Company, you've got a great car here, and I'm going to take a ride in this thing sooner or later.
Oh, yes.
And I want to congratulate you on your unveiling and wish you unlimited success in the future. Thanks for lending your voice here.
Oh, thanks very much. Yep, take care.
We now switch from news about a hot car to news you need to know about how to keep your pets safe as the temperatures continue to heat up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One thing about a heat wave, you either keep it out, or keep out of it, or you sweat and bake. And the many of us fortunate enough to have air conditioners in our homes, offices, and cars can avoid the boil. But we must be conscious that our dogs and cats, and gerbils and hamsters, rely on us to keep them safe. And it's important, because things can go terribly wrong, really fast, if you don't protect your pets. Great advice is coming up. Stay tuned. I remember talking with a veterinarian who worked with kids, and he said that one of the most significant responsibilities that kids have today is caring for their pets, because they hold the power of life and death in their hands. It is a giant responsibility. Well, that applies to we adults as well, and it's important to act right now to make sure our pets are safe during this incredible heat wave. And here's just what you and your family and friends need to know. The heat wave that's gripping America, as you look at the temperature charts these days, it is record-setting temperatures almost everywhere. People are literally now being reported as having died from this because this is very, very stressful to many people, and people who aren't prepared, elderly and others who are at risk, can find themselves in danger. But certainly one of the very big concerns that all of us have to be aware of is the need for these creatures that totally rely on us for their care to be properly prepared and dealt with at times like this. And we're talking with someone who really can speak to this. We're invite to the Wildside News now Stephanie Shane. She's the director of outreach. Her forte is focused on companion animals, and she's talking to us as a representative of the Humane Society. Stephanie, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
Well, Stephanie, you're in Maryland, and that certainly is the a center of some really record-setting temperatures. Tell me, first of all, what's been the experience of the heat wave there in Maryland?
Well, we see a lot of concern going up, and thankfully we also see a pretty good response from our news media reminding people that they need to take precautions for their pets as well as the people that they're concerned about. So that, you know, everything that we're thinking about for ourselves, keeping cool, and for neighbors and relatives who may have some trouble making sure that they're staying cool themselves, that we need to remember those same tips for our pets.
Are you receiving calls?
Pretty typical calls that shelters receive are dogs in cars. People take their dogs along in the car thinking it'll be fun for the dog to be with them, and they'll only be in the store for a moment, and a moment turns into 5 minutes or 10 minutes or longer, and that really can create an extremely dangerous situation for the dog. So calls from concerned citizens when they see a dog in a car, or as well as calls from concerned citizens who see a dog in their neighborhood or maybe that they're driving by who's tied outside and doesn't have any shade or any cool water or anything to help them through the heat of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start talking about the things that people really have to be concerned about. Obviously, as with any living thing, heat and water is very, those two elements are two of the most important. Let's talk about the importance of those four animals as well.
Sure. Water, absolutely important. You know, dogs and cats don't cool their own bodies as efficiently as people do. So if you think about, you know, you probably want more water when it's really hot out. Your pet, it's absolutely vital to them to have a lot more water when it's really hot because it helps them keep cool and maintain their hydration. Dogs get, you know, they cool themselves off by panting. So you want to make sure that they have lots of water. And shade is another very important thing. It's especially important to note that a doghouse is not shade. A doghouse in the sun is like an oven, and so there needs to be adequate shade for those animals, whether that's by a hard structure overhang or heavily, very thick trees or something that provides a consistent shade for those animals.
Well, now let's say that there's someone who has a dog and this hasn't been an issue for them, and suddenly, it's here now. What are some ways to construct shade? Obviously, it has to be reliable.
It has to be reliable, and like a plastic tarp isn't reliable, and so we don't think draping a plastic tarp over something for shade is good. You need to plan ahead, and if that means bringing the dog inside the home, then you need to do that and be prepared to do that, because it really can be a difference between life and death for that animal. We certainly see animals in the D.C. area in situations where animal control needs to go and remove them because it is so hot and they are not being provided adequate shade and adequate water, and so they need to be brought to the safety of the animal shelter.
Now, when that happens, let's say that the Humane Society responds to a call like that, they pick up the animal. What then happens for the owner? How are they contacted, and then what are their responsibilities?
It depends. Typically, some sort of notification will be left at the home, noting that animal control has responded and removed that animal, and then they would follow up whether that's coming to the shelter and retrieving their animal and making sure that they already that they have since constructed something that provides adequate shade for the animal. It could be that sometimes, an owner says, "I don't really want the dog anymore. I'm tired of the responsibility, and you took him, so you keep him."
Now, I imagine there's a fee if you pick up your animal and take it back home with you.
Normally, yes. And then, in certainly in extreme conditions, there could be the possibility of some sort of cruelty charge filed.
Mm-hmm.
It just depends on the situation.
All the more reason to just plain not let that happen. Plus, it
exactly.
Shouldn't happen. It just shouldn't happen. These are our best friends. They love us. They care for us. They protect us. They totally rely on us at times like this to protect them.
Absolutely. And a really good reminder about taking action when you see an animal in distress, that it really is up to people who care, that if you see an animal who you think needs assistance, making that call, because sometimes people are nervous to make that call. And generally, you can report, if you're nervous, you can make an anonymous complaint, but it's important that you make that call to your local animal control and ask that they come out and check on an animal in distress.
Let's talk about cats, because they seem to have some different needs, generally speaking, and yet they have the same needs.
Sure. Same concerns for cats as we have for dogs in this hot weather. Normally, we do recommend that you keep cats indoors or somehow confined to your property. We don't think it's safe to let them roam the neighborhood by themselves. There are just too many dangers that they can get into. But you want to make sure that you have the same provisions for your cat, even if she is indoors. You want to make sure that there is a cool place for her to go to. Certainly, if you have air conditioning, that's terrific. But if you don't, if there's a cooler part of your home, if you have a basement that stays cooler, making sure that the cat has access to that space during the day, making sure that there's lots of fresh water available. So everything that you would do for yourself if you were home, you want to provide for that pet to make sure that not only are they comfortable, but that they're safe.
Now, a lot of kids end up being responsible for pet care in one way or another. What's the best way that you'd recommend to really get your kids to be aware of the fact that they have to take on some added responsibility and be aware as well?
I think just having some really honest conversations. Animals die from the heat every year, and that's a really sad fact, but that's a fact. And so making kids aware that, just like us, they're creatures that need certain comforts and have certain requirements to be safe. And so you wouldn't go outside on a 90-degree day in your winter coat, and we're not sending our animal outside with his heavy, thick fur coat to sit outside all day in this heat either. Lots of times kids may have a small pet, like a hamster or a guinea pig, and you want to bring up concerns for those animals too, especially if your home is empty during the day, if everyone is at work. You want to make sure that those animals are in a cool part of the house. For example, in our home, if nobody's home, the air conditioning goes off in every room except the room that the guinea pigs are in, so that we know that they stay cool.
A lot of people like to take their dogs for a walk. There have to be some special considerations because of the heat now for dogs on walks.
Yeah, you want to limit your walks. Now is not the time to introduce a new exercise program for your dog. And you want to limit the exercise you do give your pet to early morning and late evening when it's at least the coolest part of the day, even if it is still hot. Very often it's good to have shorter, more frequent walks instead of the really long walks. So just and being mindful as well when you're walking them to any signs of distress that they may be having. You know, extremely heavy panting, it's time to get back home and get inside to the air conditioning.
Let's say that you are outside or you come home and you find your animal in distress. What are some of the signs of early distress? And then let's talk about also when you realize that there's a critical need.
Early distress really is, again, extremely heavy panting. Their tongue can turn very dark red or even purple. Any sort of sense that they seem dazed or confused or if they're having trouble walking, anything like that, you want to immediately call your emergency vet. Get that pet in a cool place. You want to get some cool water to them just to put over their body. If they are somewhat coherent, you can give them ice cubes to lick. But even those early warning signs, you want to contact a veterinarian and see what they think. If you've got a pet who is, seems severely dazed or confused, seems to be having a hard time breathing in any way, you want to get them in the car and get them to the emergency clinic right away.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, misting a dog or adding some, literally spraying it with some sort of water, might that be useful?
I think it could certainly be helpful in keeping them comfortable. But if you've got an animal who you feel is having some sort of distress from the heat, you want to get some cool water on them, and more than just a mist. You want to get some actual pretty significant amounts of cool water on them.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you do want to be mindful if you see any animal in distress, whether that is a companion-type animal or a wild animal, to check in with your animal control and let them know what you're seeing and if that's something that they can respond to and help you with.
Mm-hmm. Let's go inside the house. Whole different situations there. You're not necessarily going to be concerned about direct sunlight, but boy, houses can get pretty warm.
They can, and I think, it's a good idea that we try to conserve energy, and so a lot of folks try to shut off the air conditioning or turn it way down when they go to work, and that's a great idea to conserve energy. But if you've got pets in the house, you need to make sure that there is at least one area where they can be where it is cool.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you have one bedroom that everybody can be in during the day, even if they're not shut in there, but an area that they can all get to that is cool, or if there's a basement that stays cool, making sure that they have access to that.
Now, in the house, of course, you're going to find more exotic pets, including things like turtles and fish and birds. What are some considerations for creatures like that?
You'd want to consult specifically either with your veterinarian or with some very trusted animal care books on the species for what their ideal temperatures are. Most of these animals have adapted to living in normal, human comfortable temperatures. Some of them can tolerate warmer environments, but most of them cannot tolerate an extremely warm environment. So you don't want to make it freezing cold for them, but you do want to keep it at a temperature which you would be comfortable at.
So for people who are out there and they may find an animal in their neighborhood, let's say, that's having some real difficulties, sometimes a little frightening to take more direct action, but what would you recommend?
You can certainly try animal control and see about them, but if you can't get in touch with animal control or if you're not sure of how to find your local animal control agency, don't hesitate to call your local police department. If they cannot respond, they can direct you to the agency that can respond. I know in my own life, I've seen dogs who are in cars who seem to be in real distress, and I've not had the number for animal control with me, but I've known the number to call the police, and the police have actually come out and checked on that dog and have been willing to break into the car to help an animal in distress. So don't hesitate to call your local police if you've got a concern and you can't get in touch with animal control.
The strange thing is the pet owner may actually thank you for it in the long run, because something, it's happened to me where I've gone in to a shopping or something like that, or running to meet a friend just for a moment, and then, as you say, it can end up, you just forget.
Absolutely, and it doesn't mean, you can help that animal in distress without commenting on a pet owner overall and accusing them of being a bad owner. Sometimes we really do just forget, or else we think, we don't realize how hot, we don't think about how hot it can get in that car so quickly. Great owners, can make mistakes as well.
I know I'm an animal person, and nothing could hurt me more than to think that somehow I was partly responsible or wholly responsible for coming home to find my beloved pet dead. You've been very helpful, and you've given some terrific advice. If people want to learn more about, take this further and learn about the Humane Society, let's give them a way to find out more.
You can go to our website at www.hsus.org. And if you're specifically interested in pets, you can just add a /pets to the end of that. So it's hsus.org/pets. And you'll find information there about all kinds of animals. So not only the pet animals that we live with, but wild animals and different situations that they can get into as well.
Well, that's always useful.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Everyone sees a wild creature poking about and crossing through an open field now and then. Wildlife continues to make its stand amongst the green strips and patches that buffer our lives, and right now, they are feeling the heat. You have to wonder, how do they manage?
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Our discussion about the way in which this incredible heat wave is affecting our friends, their animal friends, that make up our life, also goes into an area that a lot of us really don't think about that much, unfortunately, and that is the fact that within our communities, we're surrounded by wildlife that we see on occasion, and most often at night when they start to come out. But, you know, during the day, they're trying to figure out how to cope with this heat, too. And joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Laura Simon, the field director of the Urban Wildlife Program of the Humane Society of the United States. Laura, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
You have a very interesting specialization, and that is urban wildlife. Am I right? Do a lot of people really not pay as much attention as they ought to with these creatures that make up our neighborhood?
It's very true. I think people either don't pay attention to them, or when they notice them, they panic, because a lot of suburban and urbanites are not accustomed to the kinds of wildlife you see increasingly in urban and suburban areas. So people don't know much about their wild neighbors, and so they have a lot of questions and concerns, and they also run into conflict with them every once in a while. So we fill the gap by trying to teach people how to live with wildlife and how to understand them.
It's interesting you say that these animals seem to be appearing more often. What's the take on that?
Well, there's a lot of theories, but mine is that with the development continuing to gobble up more and more habitat, wild animals have fewer and fewer places to go, and they are forced into areas where there's high human densities. Plus, along the way, many wild animals become very adapted to humans and get used to living with us. They habituate to our presence and are happy to live in close proximity with us. So, for example, foxes, people see them out in the day, and the old thinking was, oh my goodness, if you see a fox by day, it's rabid. But red foxes in suburban areas are out and about by day all the time, and because that's when people put out cat and dog food. So they've adapted their behaviors, and it's very common and normal to see them out by day, but people don't know that.
Well, you know, I'm with you. I personally think it's important for us to learn to get along with this, with the urban wildlife, unless there's a reason not to.
Right.
But in most cases, these are gifts to us,
yes.
And they enhance our lives, and we should really, I think, make a much greater effort to become familiar with them, try to find them, and then give them the respect that they deserve. Most of them are really just trying to get along with us.
Exactly. And I wish more people had shared your perspective, because it's true. Animals are not out there to harm us or attack us. They're not dangerous. They're just trying to eke out a living like we do, and, you know, they're willing to be neighbors to us, and I think we have to become a little more neighborly.
Well, now, at times like this, when virtually almost everywhere in America, there is this phenomenal heat wave, What could you tell us about how these animals are having to cope with this change?
It's interesting because wild animals are better adapted to deal with the heat. I mean, they're used to it. They're used to heat waves. And what they primarily do is just hunker down and get less active, and they make use of the water resources that are in their habitat. Even something like dew may become very important for animals at night. I mean, that may be their liquid nourishment. They also tend to switch over, if they can, to more liquefied foods like berries. And even insects have a very high water content for animals like raccoons. So they really conserve energy and they hunker down behaviorally. But we also encourage people to do things like, if you have birds in your backyard, which hopefully you do, you know, make sure you keep filling your bird bath. That's going to be important for the birds. And, you know, you can provide water, even the pond in your yard. You know, this is why we tell people it's really important to keep water bodies and streams in your neighborhood and not let development get rid of so many of these areas where there's water, because that may be the only water source wildlife has. And animals will take advantage of even the smallest little stream or puddle, and they get by. It's amazing how little water wild animals can survive on.
Obviously, if you see an animal, it's there because there's some sort of community. Almost always, it's because there is a successful community, so they've been able to figure out ways to meet their needs.
Exactly.
And as you say, in many cases, it's going to be some strange little pocket of water that they're aware of.
Right.
But
right.
Even at times like this, some of those as well may be disappearing.
Right.
Obviously, some people may decide that there's ways to assist. I don't really know what the best answer to that is. For example, let's say that you were concerned about coyotes that may be in your neighborhood. Is it appropriate to try to put out water or something like that? Give me a sense on that.
Yeah, I'm very mixed on that, because even though it's a kind thing to do, which, of course, we want to be compassionate to our wild neighbors, it's also tough, because when you put out food or water, you tend to attract animals, and it may become habit-forming. You start putting out food or water for them, and coyotes keep coming for food or water, and then they expect it to be there, and that may create a problem for the neighbors. But my personal feeling is, in times of supreme heat, you know, where it's just unusually high heat levels or drought levels, you know, I think if you do provision a bit with water, do it for a very temporary time period, and don't let it become habit-forming for the wild animals, because then they might, you know, start coming around to areas where other neighbors might not appreciate them so much. But bird baths, we certainly say please keep those filled. And even most importantly, and this is a battle we continually fight, is don't put out traps. Don't put out humane traps. Don't put out any kind of trap to capture any animal at this time of year, because they will literally die in the trap, and it's just the wrong thing to do. So if you need to rescue a wild animal like a skunk that fell in a window well, if you're going to do that, call us and we'll walk you through a fast way to get that animal out. But do not set any traps under any means, because the most humane trap will quickly become a very inhumane trap.
Since this is your field, you have really interesting experiences and stories, I'm sure. I'm going to kind of let you go ahead and just share some of the thoughts that you think about at times like this, maybe some of the things that you're becoming aware of, because I would find that fascinating. Just go ahead and talk as you would.
Sure. Well, we had an interesting one when I was thinking about water and drought, where these raccoons kept coming around to a house, and it was during a drought. And what they were doing is that the house, they had a leaky pipe in the house, and it was a perfect water source for these raccoons. But unfortunately, the homeowner got the leak fixed. I mean, that was fortunate for the homeowner, but not for the raccoons. And the homeowner called us and said, "Oh my goodness, what's going on? There's a ruckus every night under my house. I hear screeching." And I had her hold up the phone, and I could hear that it was raccoons. And she swore up and down that, you know, she didn't put out food for them. And then I said, "Well, what could have been going on under your house that the raccoons were attracted to?" And then we figured out it was, you know, she had this leaky pipe, and they had been really thoroughly enjoying it and using it. And but then suddenly she got it fixed, and that created a problem, because the raccoons were so used to coming there for water, and suddenly that source dried up. So in that case, I did tell her, I said, put a pan out of water, and we'll slowly wean them from it. And, you know, she couldn't sleep at night, so she did. And then when the drought ended, the raccoons had other sources of water, and there was no more problem.
Oh, that's just fascinating. And yeah. I'm intrigued by the fact that they were squawking about it.
Yeah. Well, it was the time of year when mothers had babies, and when they often, you know, the babies are very vocal. The parents, the mother is not. So the babies were just scrapping with each other. And what I imagine was happening is more than one mother was bringing her babies, and the babies were scrapping with each other, and that's what created the sound. Otherwise, she probably never would have known what was going on under there.
Well, tell us some more about some of the unusual things that may happen at a time like this, particularly when it gets very hot.
Yeah. Well, this one interesting thing, which many people might not realize, is that there actually are some animals that do benefit from heat. And, for example, people sometimes have bats in their attic, and we tell them this is not a bad thing as long as they're not getting into the inside of your home. It's great to have them in the attic because they will do free mosquito control for you every night, and, you know, it's wonderful. They can really make a dent in this mosquito population. But bats actually prefer hot temperature, like between 80 and 100 degrees, and little brown bats, which are sometimes in people's attics, actually seem to prefer temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, the heat spell is something they revel in, whereas other animals like us and any fur-bearing animal definitely are not happy about it. One other funny story we had, again, so many of our funny stories pertain to raccoons. We had a situation where there was a raccoon family in a chimney, and the homeowner, you know, we talked about it, and I explained to him how the babies would leave with the mother when they were 6 weeks old. She'd carry them out once and for all so that they could go on outings with her, and how it was hard for them to go up and down the chimney by themselves because they were too little. So that's why the mother, when they're big enough to go out on outings with her, she moves them to a ground den. So I told the homeowner, you know, don't worry, all you have to do is just wait, and at 6 weeks old, they'll be gone. And so the homeowner was happy to do it, and I said, just keep your damper closed, and when this is all done, get a chimney cap if you don't want them to come back next year. So he said, fine. And he did everything I suggested, except he forgot about the damper part. And he called me back, and he said, the weirdest thing is happening. He said, I'm a fish connoisseur, whatever fish people are who have exotic fish. He had 25 tanks of exotic fish. And he said, my fish are disappearing. Is there any disease you know of, or what's going on? And I didn't realize right away that he was the same caller who had called me about the raccoon. So we were trying to figure out why his fish might be disappearing. And suddenly it dawned on me what was happening. And I said, did you do everything I suggested with the raccoons? Did you close the damper? And he went, whoops, no, I didn't. And so he stayed up that night, and he watched. And sure enough, he said, Mama raccoon came down, went right over to the fish tank, got herself a nice little drink, and then went fishing, caught a whole bunch of his fish. He said the most expensive one she went for and got. Uh-huh. And she just very neatly, because he had a couch up against the aquarium. She very neatly just did her fishing and drinking, and then went back in the chimney and took care of her cubs. Wow. And he got such a chuckle out of it that I think in the end he did not close the damper, because it became so much fun for him to watch her come down and
hopefully
go fishing.
Hopefully he switched to some other species of fish at $19.95 or $29.95 for an exotic.
Exactly.
That can be an expensive habit, you know.
Exactly.
That's a great story.
It was hysterical. But when he called again, he never identified himself as the same caller. He just said, you're animal people. You're the Humane Society. Why would my fish be disappearing? And, you know, what's going on here? He thought there were mice or something in the house that was having an impact. So that was just a funny story.
Yeah, it is good, yeah.
A lot of what we do is detective work, and you know, wild animals, just their behaviors make sense, and we just have to put together the pieces.
Well, that's fascinating detective
work.
Yeah, as we think about this issue of heat and the urban wildlife, just go ahead and give us a kind of a cross section of the animals that people probably aren't noticing, but that are common in the urban areas, just because I think people, once they go, oh, yeah, that's interesting, I probably could learn to see some of these animals and be aware of them, give them a sense of what they're really surrounded by.
Okay. Well, in most urban areas, I mean, you'll have Are you in California?
I'm in San Diego.
So I know in your area there's a variety of ground squirrels, but in our area we have chipmunks, which make small holes in yards, and they tend to live in stone walls and areas of edge where forest meets lawn. And people will often see them. They're very cute, and they do a lot of chirping and disappearing, and they're very vocal. But people don't always like the holes they see in their yard, but then when they associate them with the creature that they enjoy seeing, then they usually enjoy them much more. The fun thing about woodchucks, you'll see them with bulging cheeks. They load up their pouches with food, and so they're kind of comical looking. Gray squirrels are probably the most common animal that people get to see in their yards and parks, and even in the middle of the most urbanized areas, you'll have a hardy population of squirrels if you have any green space at all. Wild rabbits tend to be more and more common, and people tend to not see them so much because they're pretty secretive, but in the summer months, like now, people will be mowing the lawn and encounter their babies, their nests, because the mother rabbit doesn't stay with her young. She just parks them in a hole with long grass, and lawnmowers tend to discover them, and
Yeah. That's
how people know they have rabbits in the neighborhood. Raccoons are very common, and people tend to know about them when their trash cans get upended, but they are taking advantage of attics and chimneys, and just about any place there's a niche, a raccoon will try and fill it. Skunks are pretty common in this area, and they are... People often don't know they're around till they smell them, till their dog tangles with them, but we have great solutions for that. Bats tend to be in attics everywhere, and most people never know about bats in their attic until they might go outside at dusk and suddenly see bats flying around and then swooping into a very small hole or vent in their house. So often people can be living with lots of wildlife in and under their houses and yards and trees, and they never know about them. Even if you go out at night and you take a flashlight and sort of shine it up in the trees, you might see glowing eyeballs looking back at you, and that's raccoons usually. Their eyes are very fluorescent and in the nighttime, and they will glow back at you. But, you know, they'll often be so quiet you'll never know. They're in the tree right next to your porch. But what we try and teach people is that there's lots of wildlife around you, but they're not harmful. They're just doing their thing, and if you, you know, aren't aware of them, they still might be there, and that's a good thing, you know. So try and look for them more, and listen in the early morning to the incredible bird life you get in the most urbanized areas. It's incredible. Green space, even teeny pockets of it, will bring you a lot of wildlife. Particularly, it's interesting if you supply some water, because greenery and water are all many wild animals need, and they appear out of nowhere. Fox in the middle of New York City. People say, how do you get there? We recently had a couple coyotes go into central Manhattan. Nobody knows how they got there, but they'll get there time and time again because they're eking out a living and we're not giving them much space to live in, but they'll take advantage of the little scraps we do give them.
I was driving along last Saturday, early in the morning, and I live in North County, San Diego, and so it's quite a bit of green. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, walking across the road was a coyote, mm-hmm. a little skinny, scrawny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's startling because it's thrilling. Quite honestly, it's thrilling.
It is.
To see these animals, and he looks at me, and there's some sort of communication where he's kind of going, "You're going to be cool, right?" And then he wandered off, and I was, you know, it filled me with something that was so terrific. It's wonderful.
It is wonderful.
And as you say, it's funny, too, because the other night I woke up and I had heard someone talking about the fact that birds, the sound of animals actually is distributed. They're not all talking on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
So at night, I went out about midnight and started listening to the night bird calls. And I'll encourage all of my listeners to do this. Pay attention and realize that they're taking turns. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
When you realize that they're actually, one bird will go off for a while and no other birds will be calling.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden a different bird or other creature will make noises, and they literally share the sound space, which is fascinating.
It is fascinating. And they're actually, what people don't realize is that they're talking to each other. There's communication going on. It's not just everybody yelling at once. It's actual communication going from one animal to another, and it's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, things like, as you're saying, coyotes, an animal is wild as a coyote. There he just pops up and looks at you, and you know, you form this rapport. It's just this incredible energy and empathy and connection to wildlife and the sort of the wilderness, the little bit that exists, you can have in a second of time just seeing an animal like that. And a lot of people out here tend to see coyotes in a different light because they all read The Big Bad Wolf and the fairy tales, and they think these animals are out to get them. Whereas we explain to people, you know, what coyotes are primarily looking for are mice. And, you know, if they look at you, it doesn't mean they're about to attack you. Right. They're just interested in you. They're looking at you like you're looking at them. But, you know, what they prey on is a whole different story. It's much smaller prey items that are far more helpless, and that humans are very safe from coyotes.
Well, I'm prejudiced because I consider these my friends. I always get the sense, and I approach wildlife with the idea that they actually are begging for us to just get along and mm-hmm. and cohabit.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's their natural inclination. I mean, it's so rare that any wild creature, unless they're provoked or they're diseased or traumatized, would attack humans. It's just
yeah.
very rare. What we're talking about is cohabiting with the creatures, and a lot of people that I know, when they find the creatures in their yards, they end up, you know, calling someone to come and remove it. What's your take on that from the perspective of the Humane Society?
Okay, we generally do not support or recommend removal of wildlife as a way to solve problems, and I'll explain why. The biggest problem is that during spring and summer, that's the birthing season for most wild animal species, and that's when they go in and under people's homes to have private cavities to raise their young. So this is the time of year when the worst thing that can happen is for the mother to be trapped out and her babies left behind to starve. And so we strongly discourage trapping for that reason, because when a person, say, goes and rents a trap or buys a so-called humane trap, they often trap out the mother. And whether they relocate her or kill her, they leave babies behind that normally starve. I mean, it's just a bad scene. Plus, the other terrible thing is that there's a new industry right now, a wildlife extermination industry that has grown up in the past decade or so. And it's one of the fastest growing industries out there. And these are people who will come to your home, and for hundreds of dollars, they will trap and remove wild animals for you. And some of them will kill them, some relocate them. But the outcome is the same. It's really not good for the animals, and in many cases it's a very sad outcome. And it's not the approach we want to see. What we tell people instead is the problem is not that an animal is in your home. The problem is that there's food or a denning site there, and that's where you need to solve the problem. So if you're attracting animals to your home because you're leaving out garbage or dog food or cat food, you have to change your own garbage disposal practices, or stop putting dog food and cat food out all night if you don't want to attract certain animals. And likewise, if you've got holes in your house, you are going to have animals in there with young. So the trick is to do a great home proofing job in early spring and go around your house on the inside and the outside and plug up any holes, because if your house has a chimney cap and you've got no holes in your house, then you're not going to have animals in your house. So that's the answer. And when we get calls from people who, say, have a raccoon family in the attic, the first thing we try and do is see if they'll give the animal a grace period. Let the mother raise her young until they're big enough, and then allow them to leave on their own. And at that point, the person needs to close off the entry hole. A lot of people are willing to accept that. But some people really don't want that animal in their home no matter what. They want them out now. And in those cases, we teach people how to evict animals, meaning teaching the mother that the nesting, denning place she has chosen is no longer safe. And when we harass her, or when we teach the homeowner how to harass her properly, the mother will move her own babies out. And that's the most humane solution, because it's not trapping and removing animals and separating them from their mother. It's getting the mother to move her own babies out on her own, and often will use lights or different bad sounds, smells, different kinds of techniques to teach the mother this is no longer a place where you're welcome. But we always, always, always tell the person that getting the animal out is not the answer. If you don't want them to return, you have got to do that final act of home proofing, and that may mean putting a chimney cap on your flue or sealing up holes, but When the animal is gone, the problem's not gone.
It's educating the animal. These animals are very intelligent,
right,
and they know when they're not wanted.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we have some comical situations, like we've dealt with a number of, speaking of water, situations where raccoons, you know, are taking advantage of boats because people aren't using or haven't been using them much, and so the raccoons take over and they have their young on boats, and, you know, they love it. They go down the dock at night and bring the kids with them, but then suddenly a person's out on his boat and here's a raccoon, a mama raccoon behind them. So animals will pop up in a lot of strange places, but if you tell mom this is not a place where you're welcome, she will move on. And that is the best answer, but trying to trap and remove her or kill her is just unnecessary. Plus, to pay somebody hundreds of dollars to do it is just crazy.
And quite honestly, you know, an interesting thing for people to try is when you run across animals like that, literally talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Try to explain. No, it sounds a little odd, but mm-hmm. you know what? They are trying to read you. They're trying to figure out what you want.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
as you know, if you communicate to them you know, this is not a good place, they can tell by the sound of your voice that
mm-hmm.
you're not, you know, they're very perceptive. That's
yeah.
just so fascinating.
Yeah.
Now we'll wrap this up at this point.
Sure.
And it's been a fascinating conversation. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
For people, and let's get back to the topic of the excessive heat. Let's say people come across a wildlife creature
mm-hmm.
who they think is somehow being stressed by this situation one way or another. What should they do?
Yeah. Well, if they want to temporarily put out a pan of water, you know, as long as they don't just leave it out permanently, I think that can just help an animal get through a very heat-stressed time. And usually there's enough shelter for wildlife and even enough water that they really don't have to worry about them. If there's any water in a habitat, usually animals know about it, but certainly in the worst heat waves, if they put out a shallow pan of water for wildlife, you know, and I say shallow because, you know, mice and other animals jump into deeper pans and drown, but if they put out a shallow pan, that can help an animal get by for a few days or a week until the cooler weather and normal rainfall will occur. But I know in your area, animals are very well adapted to so little rain and water that I think that most of the time they're doing just fine if we just leave them alone.
Well, I mean, if you're driving along, let's say you're walking, and you see an animal that looks as if it's in trouble,
mm-hmm.
What would you recommend?
Well, if it's in trouble, it's probably in trouble because it's injured or orphaned or something else is wrong. And you can always call your state Department of Natural Resources or Nature Center to locate a wildlife rehabilitator who can usually help out, or at least answer your questions.
Well, Laura Simon, Field Director of the Urban Wildlife Program with the Humane Society of the United States, this has been just fabulous. You have a fun job, and you're doing some great work.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, too. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now.
Mm-hmm, bye. You have to admit we are getting plenty of warnings that it's time, actually way past time, to make some changes so that we can somehow manage to get along between nations and religions and between we humans and the mystery of the living world that is doing its best to sustain life on Earth. Things are heating up. Let that be the warming. It's time to cool it down a notch or two and get back to the peace we all deserve. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.